Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience. You're listening once again to another edition of Religion Means Live. I'm your host, Imam Alfred. We're having some technical problems with the broadcast today. We're trying to load the page. As some of you might know, this broadcast is from via the computer. We're supposed today to have on the program Sister Christine Colon. She is not able to be with us today. I'm trying to load the page and give us some time just to see whether we can. That lady didn't. She, I ain't heard nothing. Nobody called me.
She ain't call you?
No.
She never called you?
No, she's bullshit.
Wow, she really lied.
She didn't give her name.
She's a hard liar. She gave her real name. I don't even know if that's
her
real name.
Telephone number?
No, she never gave us a telephone number.
Who she had with her?
She didn't have no realtor. She said she was a realtor herself.
She wanted to bond for herself.
Uh-huh.
Oh.
She never called you, Danny.
No.
She never called you. Sure?
No, I'm done.
So, she said she called you twice.
No, she can text me.
That makes no sense. Wow. She said she called you. I don't know how to log in.
Where's Alpha's phone?
She's running with him. I'm going to get a haircut. He got picture day or whatever tomorrow. I'm sorry. Hold on. It's only 2 minutes. Blasso got the mobile website better. Remember, it used to be really bad?
Yeah.
Let's see if we can enter the studio. Is she on, the lady? She might be. Work out should be popping up. All right. Now, if you want to go back to the phone, you know how to do it, right? Just write down.
Okay, that's it. I ain't good at it, so it's not.
Hold on.
Yeah,
Sam.
You can put it on my tab. Go and get that.
All right, where's it at?
Okay. Wow, there's a lot of people listening. Okay.
Yeah, it is.
All right. Now, let's see.
I was talking all the time. Just talk.
No, I wasn't.
Who's on mute?
Wait, let me see.
I wasn't on mute. Peace be on our noble, honorable listening audience. We are back on the air. We didn't know where we were, but there's some technical problems with this broadcast. Due to the fact that we are having some technical difficulties, so I'm going to play a broadcast that was here. We're not even the technical difficulties. What happened is we had a guest, a young lady by the name of Christina Colon. She was supposed to be with us today. She's not with us. All right. So, just bear with us a moment. And I'm going to have an open forum today, even though I want you to give you some good health news. We have already started treatment for prostate cancer. So we are doing a lot better, feeling better, more energized. And dear beloved people,
We're on our way to making progress. I'm talking while I'm trying to get back to the blog, talk radio, to the board. And as soon as we can get back to the board, we're going to get our program. May God, that is the creed of the heavens and the earth, bless you. May he give you peace, contentment, and I want to read to you something that just recently read in the New York New Republic about Cornel West, Professor Cornel West, that is, Michael Eric Dyson. It is called The Ghost of Cornel West. The Ghost of Cornel West. I think Ismail Kadar was supposed to do the show today. But what I'm going to do today, since I'm not really up to it, I'm going want to read this from The Ghost of Cornel West. President Obama betrayed him. He stopped publishing new works. He alienated his closer friends and allies. What Happened to America's Most Exciting Black Scholar? By Michael Eric Dyson, illustrated by Hello Vaughn, April 19, 2015. Nor hell a theory like a woman is the best known line from We Raised the Morning Bride, but I'm concerned with the phrase preceding it, which captures wrath and the moral universe turn. Heaven has no rage like love to hatred turn. Even an angry almighty can't compete with mortals who love turn to hate. Let me just stop you and say that's not true. We don't believe that the almighty, the creator of the heavens and earth, has any human feeling. We don't believe that. So God doesn't have any feeling. God is not angry. God doesn't have wrath. He doesn't have rage. That's a human. So that's not God. So Reverend Michael Dyson, you're wrong. Cornel West's rage against President Barack Obama evokes the count of Benin. He has accused Obama of political ministry, calling him a Rockefeller Republican blackface, taunted him as a brown-faced Clinton, and derided him as a neoliberal opportunist. In 2011, West and I were both speakers at a black newspaper conference in Chicago. During a private conversation, West asked how I escaped being dubbed an Obama hater when I was just as critical of the president as he was. I shared my three-part formula for discussing Obama before black audience. Start with love for the man and pride of his epic achievement. Focus on his the unprecedented acrimony he faced as the nation's first black executive and taught his missteps and failure. No matter how vehemently I disagree with Obama, I respect him as a man wrestling with an incredible, difficult opportunity to shape history. Well, I guess there's a difference between me and you. I don't respect the brother at all. West's animus is longstanding and only intermittently broken by bouts of calculated love. In February 2007, West lambasted Obama's decision to announce his bid for the president in Illinois and stood up at a journalist cabin spouting State of the Black Union meeting in Virginia, calling it proof that the nation candidate wasn't concerned about black people. Come out there is not fundamental about us. It's about somebody else. Obama got a large number of white brothers and sisters with fears and anxiety, and he got to speak to them in such a way that he holds us at arm's length. It's hard to know which is more astonishing. West faulted Obama for starting this White House running the state where he's been elected to the United States Senate, a breathtaking and insulary, equating Smiley's conflict with black America. Despite West's approval of Obama, he eventually embraced the political phenomenon, called the country as a surrogate and touting his Oval Office bona fides. The two public embraced at a 2007 Apollo Theater fundraiser in Harlem, joined with West, Christian Obama, my brother, companion, and comrade. Obama praised West as a genius, a public intellectual, a preacher, an orator, and a loving person. Obama West welcomed West's support because he is a juggernaut of the academy and an intellectual icon among the black masses. If black scholars like prize fighters, then West is not the greatest ever. The title belonged to W.E.B. Du Bois, not the most powerful ever. That's Henry Louis Gates. Not the most influential. That would include Nobel Prize winner Toni Morrison, Black History Week founder Carter G. Woodson, historian John O. Franklin, feminist Bell Hooks, Afrocentric pioneer of Malathe Asante, and undoubtedly Julius Wilson, whose sociological research has profoundly shaped racial debate and the public policy of elite through president. West may be a heavyweight champion of controversy, but he's class competition as the pound for pound greatest sociologist. Oliver Cox, E. Franklin Frazier, and Lawrence D. Bobo. Historian Robin D.J. Kelly, Nell Irvin Painter, and David Levy Lewis, political science Cedric Robinson, and Manon Marble. Our historian Richard J. Powell, legal theorist Kimberly Crenshaw and Randall Kennedy, cultural critic Tricia Rose, and the literary scholar Weston Spiller, and Farrell, Jasmine Griffiths, all were the contenders. Yet, West, in my exhibition, the most exciting black American scholar ever, and his peak Eastern ideal stopped the last with great vitality. His fluency in a remarkable range of disciplines spills effortlessly from his pen, and the public performance of his massive erudition inspired many of his students to try to follow suit, from religious study scholar Ove Hendricks and Eddie Claude to cultural critic Imani Perry and Dwight McBride. West may not be Muhammad Ali, Joe Louis, Jack Johnson, Jerry Joe Walcott, or Sugar Ray Robinson. He more Mike Tyson, a prodigiously gifted champion, who rose to the throne earlier and tore through opponents with stout menace and ferocity. His reign was brutal, his punch devastating, his impact staggering. It was a sense of scholarly excitement that drew me to West after reading his first book, Prophecy Deliverance, in 1982. The book validated the intellectual passion I courted in my youth, never leaving me as I navigated some challenging circumstances. I had been a promising student from a Detroit ghetto who won a scholarship to a prestige boarding school outside of town on the condition I repeat the 11th grade. I confronted racism head on for the first time at that new school, and it rocked me. I was expelled during my second year for poor performance. I returned to the inner city and the prospect of collecting my diploma at night school. I got married, became a teenage father, one who worked in the automotive supply factory, and also odd jobs after high school. I didn't start college in the fall of 1979, 1 month before my 21st birthday. That same year, I divorced my son's mother after moving south to attend the historical Black Knoxville College. My father died 2 years later, and I made do for a spell with the only material inherited he could pass on, a Chevy station wagon that had once served as a work vehicle for our Dyson and Son grass cutting, sod land, and odd job enterprise. Over the next few years, I served as a pastor at 3 different churches in Tennessee while completing my degree at Carson Newman College, 20 miles northeast of Knoxville, where I transferred in 1981 to get a perm for footing in my study of philosophy. When West's book was published, my phone service at home had been shut off because I had no money to pay the bill. There was a paid telephone outside the laundromat where I washed my clothes, and one day, instead of doing the laundry, I spent my last $5 calling West at his Union Theological Seminary off in New York City. I rhapsodized by his philosophical acumen and cutting-edge theory of race for a while, and West let on that he heard about me from a mutual friend and encouraged me to stay in touch. I took him at his word and soon found up the money to drive the 600 miles to Tennessee to see him deliver a series talk at Kalamazoo College. West had not yet freed himself from reading his lectures about the rhetorical style which he's just to celebrate. An extemporaneous exploration of ideas, the thesisly improvised flourishes and tonal colors of a jazz musician, the rhythmic shift and sonic manipulation of a gospel preacher. Yet even then, West mesmerized effortlessly, shattered the broad waves of Western thought, defending the notion of black humanity while laying siege to white sectarianism, proven by his own impossible literary performance that white superiority was a lie at least as long as his gap-toothed mouth spit out esoteric knowledge. We're on the air. West and I became dear friends. Excuse me. We're on the air. We're broadcasting. Wes and I became dear friends. Our mind has penetrated the intellect, and he nurtured my deepening commitment to a life of a mind. Wes wrote a letter of recommendation on my behalf when I applied to graduate school in 1984 and helped me to land at his alma mater, Princeton, where he had been the first black student ever to earn a doctorate in philosophy, where I became the second black student to earn a doctorate in religion. Wes had a huge crush on the rhythm and blues singer Anita Baker, and I got us a ticket to see her perform in New Jersey. After brief backstage introduction to the singer, Alfred Nagel, Wes relived his high school track glory and sprinted up the street in glee. As a graduate student, I rang for Wes to lecture at Princeton in the late 80s before he was an academic superstar, and I can still remember how he invented the grapple with the decline of European dominate, the rise of American hegemony, and the decolonization of third world countries, even as he spoke of the pervasive influence of black culture and the broader life of a nation, cite Matthew Arnold, T.S. Eliot, Lionel Trillins, and Francis Fanon as major witnesses to the trend he outlined. I had an observed literary scholar, Houston Baker, dazzle another Princeton audience with a dynamic and dramatic lecture. But Wes stopped to perform with the sheer breadth of his inquiry and the erudite ad-libs to his written presentation. Wes' early work was a marvel of rigor and imagination. He wrote The Beast of Philosophy with linguistic panache as he snapped deep concepts and big thinkers in his theoretical lasso, and the hurl herded thousands of stalking students in the Ivy League classroom, packed to the rafters and prophecy delivered. Wes invited Foucault to sing the insurrection of subjugated knowledge and the black revolution acquired American evasion of philosophy, ingenuously pitched American pragmatism as a multiracial conversation that includes Randolph, Woodrow, Emerson, Du Bois, and Richard Rothery. In keeping faith, Wes gathered a slew of similar essays on subjects like social theory and the philosophy of religion, baptizing Paul Strucker's thought in American water by translating the insight of his biggest European style with analytic ways. At the age of 39, Wes catapulted to fame after struggling financially and became deserving of Far Richer Man, but publicated his best work, 1993, Race Matters. It isn't a scholarly book, per se, although its pages go the weight of his formidable intellect as he traces the cultural dynamics of race with exquisite and uncharacteristic for the first time lucidity. This jargon, whether it's the zenith and the most modern academy of the 1990s, Race Matters changed how we speak of black identity in the United States. It gave our country the golden point for matters of race that mattered more than they should and brought West the sort of celebrity that is intoxicating and distracting. West garnered glowing profiles in Newsweek and Time. And the same week, he put his ideas on radio with Terry Gross and on television with Bill Maher and Bill Maher. There was a certain satisfaction in West. Right. One of the smartest men of his generation also became one of his most popular. The intellectual landscape had shifted dramatically beneath West's feet by the time Obama went after president. The internet and social media ushered in new voices on the nation's most vexing problem and made room for fresh thinking on race and identity. Even as the pace of West public scholarship slowed, he remained a powerful cultural presence. If West's most notable book argued that race mattered, his celebrity and iconic status meant that his endorsement also mattered. West remained allied with Obama until he took the White House and in football parlance, fake left and ran right. Obama posed as a progressive and turned out to be counterfeit, West complained in an interview with Salon. He acted as he was concerned about digital truths and justice equality. It turned out that he's just another neoliberal centralist with a smile and a nice rhetorical flair. It's worth noting that the president acted in keeping with demands of his profession, like most recent Democratic politicians. Obama nodded in a progressive direction while campaigning, but towed a more centrist line when it comes to government. What distinguished West is he's to sell Obama's insufficient leftism, but claimed his racial betrayal. I'd rather have a white president fundamentally dedicated to eradicating poverty and enhancing the plight of working people and a black president tied to Wall Street and drones, he told the Guardian. Long before their ideological schism, however, West believed himself personally betrayed by Obama because of his supposed disinterest after an election. It is a sad truth that most politicians a serial rhetorical lover, a promiscuous ideological mate, leaving behind scores of briefly voted surrogate supporters. West should have understood that Obama had a similar trials with many others, but West felt spurned and was embittered. That's where Congress insight on love to vote, the rage come crashing in. West repeatedly declared that he did 65 engagements with the president's campaign in 2008 and was offended when the president revived tickets to the inauguration. Obama later told me in the White House that West left several voicemails, including prayers from a blocked number with no instruction of when to return the call, a routine which I was all too familiar. And a 2011 interview with Chris Hayes on Truth Big that fit under the headline, The Obama Deception, while Cornell West went ballistic. West recalled his indignation during the inauguration when he arrived at the Washington Hotel with his mother, and she noted that the bellman had a ticket in the bed, but not her son. I couldn't get a ticket for my mother and my brother, West said. We drive into the hotel, and the guy who picks up my bag from the hotel has a ticket to the inauguration. My mom said, there's something that this dear brother can get. That's something this dear brother can get a ticket. You can't get one. Honey, all the work you did for him for miles. Thus, the left-wing critics found it unjust that the working man and not the professor had a ticket for the inauguration. Only in a world where bankers and other fat cats greedily garbage reward meant for everyday citizens with such a reversal would be unfair. J.P. Morgan might have been mad. Karl Marx would have been ecstatic. The moment for West followed his pronouns in decades, long scholarly decline. Something that did not escape the notice of other academics and intellectuals. None more notable than Lawrence Summers, the former president of Harvard, who clashed publicly with West. West departed Harvard for Princeton in 2002. Summers had reminded West for his Versailles project, everything from advising President Al Sharpton's failed presidential bid to his vanity musical venture. I could endorse these criticisms, but I knew Summers was right when he pointed to West's diminished scholarly output. It's not only that West preoccupied Obama perceived felt distracted, though that is true. More accurately, be to say that the last 7 years revealed West's paucity of serious and fresh intellectual work, a trend far longer in the making. West is still a man of ideas, but those ideas today are vain and unimagined repackaging of his early years. He hasn't published without the aid of a co-writer a single scholarly book since Keeping Faith, which appeared in 1993, the same year as Race Man. West has repeatedly tried to reach the glory of that slim classic by imitating the 1960-era rhythm and blues singers he loved so much. Making all of the songs sound like one at the top of the chart. In 2004, West published Democracy Matters, obviously recycled both the title and theme of his work as a decade earlier. It was his biggest seller since Race Man. Even a cursory survey of West's recent work captured the noticeable diminution of his intellectual force. Hope on a Tightrope, 2008, is mostly a collection of Wesleyan wisdom spoken and then transcribed. The cover feature West standing on the backboard of the word. What would West say? Chalked again like an after-school punishment. A haunting Hooper suggested a parallel of what Jesus would do. What would Jesus do? His memoir, Brother West, is embarrassing, far-gone, scholarly aspirations, breathless self-congratulations. West Winston Dean, his co-author, The War Against Pines, a similar text, praises Race Matters as the right book at the right time and bragged that Democracy Matters sold over 100,000 copies, landed number 5 on the New York Times bestseller, and continues to influence many. None of this compete with the description on West's website of his first spoken word album, Sketches of My Culture, which claims at the time of its release that in all modesty, this project constituted a watershed moment in musical history. Brother West was co-written with David Rich, a writer best known for album Leaner Notes and ghostwriting entertainers, biography, the sure sign of West's dramatic plump from his perch as a world-class intellect. It's one thing for Ray Charles to turn to Rich, another thing entirely for a top-shelf scholar to concede that he can't write for himself. It's too busy to do so. It's akin to Du Bois hiring Truman Capote to fashion his autobiography. The journalist David Massey Carter called The Rich and the Restless, which was co-authored this time by Tavis Smollett, a cover version of a hit performed better by other singer, Barbara Innerhalb. Joseph Stiglitz, William James Wilson, 96. West's latest black prophetic five public classes is another talk book. This one edited by Christopher Buschendorf, a German scholar, who interviewed last October, Master Kakura reviewed five of the Daily Beasts and called it a strange and disappointing combination of Western's metamorphosis from a philosopher to celebrity, one that is keeping with his pattern of not solely authoring any book in the past 10 years, if you count. That's two talk books and two co-authors, one across a decade, not quite up to the high scholarly standard West set for himself long ago. And Brother West admits that he's more of a natural reader than a natural writer, and the writing requires a concerted effort and forced discipline, but that he reads as easily as I breathe. I can say with certainty as a college professor for the last quarter century that most of my students feel the same way. What more, West off-the-cuff riffs and rants spoken into a microphone and later transcribed to page lacks the discipline of a written word. West's rhetorical genius is unnoubted, but there are limits on what speaking can do for someone trying to wrestle angels or battle demons to the page. There's no biased preference for the written word over the spoken. I'm far from a champion Eurocentric paradigm of literature. This is about scholars versus improvisational speaking bad wonders. The emergence on the spot, turns of thought, the pathway of insight, one hadn't planned, and the rapture discovered in front of a live audience, a meaning that usually lies buried beneath the rubbles of formal restriction and literary convention. Yet, West's inability to write is hugely confining. For scholars, there is a depth that could only be tapped through the rigorous reworking of the same sentence until the meaning comes clean, as clean as one can make it. The ecstasy of a spoken word when scholarship at stake leaves the deep reader in the long list of hungry for more. Writing is an awful, painful task that can feel like the death of one past. Equally as comforting in seeing one's presence, commitment to truth crumbles once one begins to tap away at the keyboard or scar the page with ink. Writing demands a different sort of apprenticeship to ideas and thus speaking. It beckons one to revisit over and extend at least delayed periods the same material and to revise what one thinks. Revision is reading again and again what one writes so that one can think again and again about what one wants to say and in turn determine if better and deeper things can be said. West admires the Socratic process of questioning ideas and practice and fruitful dialogue. While this may elicit thought, he yearns to express anyhow. He's at the mercy of his interlocutors. Thus, when West invades Sampees and Kvetches, he gets on a roll that might be amplified and conversated by the rest of the print. It's not a matter of skill for editing, so that the verbal repetition set pieces that origins depend on get clipped and swept aside with the read. That is wrong. It is a conceptual framework that suffers in translating what's spoken to what's written, since writing is a contrived naturalness, rigging the system's meaning to turn out the way you want and make it look normal and edible in the process. Well, you know, this is a lot of reading to do. I'm going to go to the phone and see what you think. Let's go to... to the phone and see what you think. And you can join the conversation. I'm sorry. You can join the conversation at 805-727-7013. 805-727-7013. What say you about what we read and discussed? I'm improvising today because my guest didn't show up. Some of you may not understand this, but this is a difficult task. So if we have with us people from Philadelphia, from Swanee, Georgia, from Daytona Beach, Florida, from Orlando, Florida, any of you like to discuss what we just talked, please press 1 on your phone and you will be in touch. Religion Means Alive is on the air. I'm your host, Imam Alfred, the host of Religion Means Alive. If you'd like to join the conversation, just dial 805-727-7013. I'm going to continue to read from the rest of this West End diatribe, and I may add by telling you I frankly think, I'm sending out a text. Just, I must tell you, writing and broadcasting can be a very, very extraordinarily lonely task. So let us continue reading, hoping that you will join the conversation. And I hate to tell you that this is probably one of Professor Mike Irk Dyson's better work, but in his central tenet of the West argument and the centerpiece of his public identity is his belief about prophet, and more important, his claim to be one. West follows up the prophetic prophecy delivered with prophetic fragments of 1988 collective essay lectures and speeches. Two more followed in 1993, prophetic thought and prophetic engagement, and postmodern time prophetic reflection. I'm a prophetic Christian freedom fighter, West wrote in one essay, and his memoirs. I see my role as someone who feels both Socratic and prophetic calling. Prophetic in the Judeo-Christian tradition draws on divine inspiration to speak God's word on earth. They're called by God to advocate for the poor and vulnerable while decrying unrighteousness and battling injustice. Among black American prophecies are rooted in religious stories overcoming oppression while influencing the moral vision of a social activist. Black prophets are highly esteemed because they symbolize black resistance to white supremacy, stoke insurgents against the oppression of our freedom, inspire combat against social and political oppression, and risk their lives in the service of their people and the nation's ideas. To remind us of the full measure of God's love for the weak and unprotected, especially in an era when prophets have been co-opted, turned into a bland cultural commodity, and marketed as the basis of enterprise and exploits of major corporations' political gain. We see this phenomenon each year during the birthday celebration for Martin Luther King, one of the greatest figures for both black and U.S. history, and someone who's revered as a prophet. Fast food, corporate, trumpet, king's messages of togetherness, and yet often fail to pay a living wages to their workers. Even as conservative politicians pay homage to King's memory while implementing voter ID laws that imperils the franchise for millions of black citizens. The same culture that killed King now seeks to kill contemporary expression of its prophetic itinerary by portraying today's actors such as those found in Black Lives Matter and the movement to end police brutality as the moral opposite of its social vision in 60-era nonviolent protests. The argument over who and what is prophetic has rarely been more heated in black culture than it is now. The model for the charismatic black male leader has come in for deserved rubbings, since it overlooked the contribution to women and children that often went unheralded in the civil rights movement and early black freedom struggles. Queer activists sparked the Black Lives Matter movement, underscoring the unknowledge sacrifice of black folk who are confined to the closet and corners of black existence. Even those who enjoy a direct relation to King and to Malcolm X haven't escaped scrutiny. Louis Farrakhan is faulted and praised for his distance from Malcolm's racial politics, and Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton have been pillared for lacking King's gravitas and grace. The truth of those assessments is not as important as the value of the comparison. It holds would-be prophets that count the standards of achievement, both noble and real and imagined. Despite the profusion of prophecy in his text and talk, West has never bothered to tell us in rich detail what make a personal prophet. He doesn't offer theory of prophets so much as announce their virtues and functions while grieving over their lost art and practices. In Black Prophetic Fire, West offers sweeping assessment of contemporary black life. Black people once put a premium on serving the community, lifting others, and finding joy and empowering others, he wrote. Black people once had a strong prophetic tradition and looked in every voice. Today, however, black people have succumbed to individualistic projects and pursuit of wealth, health, and status. They engage in the petty practice of chasing dollars. West offered no empirical proof of those claims, That's so much of his recent work. They are asserting without sustained and compelling arguments, and certainly no polls or studies to prove the increase of black materialism or individualism or the decline of black prophetic belief and behavior. What's failed to carefully chart the history and ethical art of prophecy leads into wild overstatement. To paraphrase Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart's famous definition of pornography, West may not seek to define a prophet, but he knows one when he sees one, and quite often they sound like him. This limp understanding of prophecy plays to his advantage because he can bless or dismiss prophets without answering how we determine who prophets are. Who gets to say so? How they are different from social critics to whom they answer, if they have a standing religious community, or if God called them. That's never given us a detail compared to now the prophecy. In Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and Zoroastrian, nor has he distinguished between major and minor prophets. He hasn't explored the difference between social and political prophecy, examined the faithful connection between the biblical gift of prophecy and his cultural determinants, a link to understand the prophecy to secular expression of the prophetic urge found in New Left radicalism, for example, which led to Jack Newfield's notable analysis of the movement and a prophetic minority. To be fair, Newfield didn't spend a great deal of time exploring prophecy either. But then he didn't pass himself a prophet like West, nor did he viciously lambast those who fall short of this expectation of standard. What made West a prophet? Is his willingness to call out corporate elites and assail the purveyors of injustice and equality? That's what Russell Brand does that in his book Revolution. Is he a prophet? Is it West self-identificate with the poor? Tupac Shakur, go ahead, this on lock. Should we deem him a prophet, or is it West self-styled resistance to police brutality evidenced by his occasional willing to get arrested in highly staged camera-ready gestures of civil disobedience, such as in Ferguson last fall? West sees King as a prophet, but Jackson and Shopman were also put at rest in public as ontologically addicted to cameras, according to West. King used cameras to gain attention for the movement. In fact, West failed to mention his attack on Jackson, the head house Negro on the Clinton plantation, and Shopman, the head house Negro on the Obama plantation. The hypocrisy just claimed as acute. West likewise hunger for the studio and convicted himself. There he is on scene, extolling his prophetic pedigree. There he is on MSNBC discussing his arrest in person while footage of the event rolled. There he is in a recording booth making not spoken words or hip hop, but grimly earnest sonic hybrid of speech and music, saying, if I can reach one young person with a message embedded in a sound that still hears or her soul, then I'm not leaving in vain. There he is in the Matrix sequel doing something he's become tragic, comedy good at, planned and unintentional cartridges of his own identity. West most closely identified with a black prophetic tradition that has deep roots in the church. But ordained ministers and especially pastors must give account to the congregation or denomination that offer them institutional support and legitimacy to prophesy. They may face severe consequences, including excommunication, censorship, being defrocked, or even expelled from their parishes for their act. The words and prophetic actions of these brave souls impact their ministerial standing and their vocation. West faced no such penalty for his pretense to Christian prophecy. West may argue that not being ordained, leaving free to act on a prophetic instinct, even disagree with the church on social matters. Does he avoid the negative consequences of ordination while remaining spiritual? That's fine if you're running a mere Christian, but there is and should be a higher standard for prophets. True prophets embrace religious authority and bravely stand up to it in the name of our power. The effort to escape responsibility should sound an alarm for those who are West's view about how prophets should behave. One need not be Martin Luther King to qualify as a prophet. But when you claim to be a prophet, you expect as the classic gospel sound goes to live the life you sing about in your song. As ordained minister and professor, I know the difference between the professorate and the pastorate, between prophet and scholar. When I utter progressive beliefs about equal rights for women and queer folks as a professor, I'm sometimes lauded. When I was a church pastor, not a prophet, sometimes I have never claimed to be.
the same sermon that got a praise from progressive scholars earned me scorn from church officials and members, and even called me a pastor when I tried to put my belief in action and ordain women as deacons. As a freelance itinerant, non-ordained, self-anointed prophet, West only has to answer himself. They may symbolize the grand resistance institutional authority, but it's also a failure of knowledge to institute responsibility that a religious prophet bears. Most ministers are clerks attending to the needs of the local parish. Only a select few are cut from prophetic clothes, yet they are all the religious figures we recognize as prophets. Adam Clayton Powell, Jr., King, Jackson Chop, were ordained as ministers. Powell and King were pastors of local churches as well. To be sure, there are prophets who are not ministers of religious figures, especially women, to the ministry have been brought by sexist theology, but most of them have ties to organizations and institutes to hold them accountable. Well, it's still a matter of ideas, but those ideas are vain and unimagined, repackaged of his earlier. West has a measure of responsibility as a professor, but he enjoys far greater freedom than most ministers of prophets. Professors have a lot of flexibility in teaching class, advising students, writing books, and speaking their minds without worrying that a deacon board will censor them or trustee will boot them out. Prophets in the world don't have tenure. West get the benefit of associating with prophecy while banned out of his burden by refusing to take up the cross. He urged prophetic Christians to carry West. West is preaching the truth while seeking to avoid reprisal. Plan it saved means that West doesn't qualify for the prophetic role of these spouse. West lack of understanding of the prophetic tradition is perhaps most evident in his criticism of Sharpton and Jackson. He berates them for their appetite for access to power, their desire for insider status. Even if we concede for the moment that this is true, it isn't a failure that prophecy about West's ability to distinguish between kinds of prophets. In his 1995 book, the preacher King Duke Divinity School Professor Richard Leisher noted that in ancient Israel, the central prophet moved within the power structure, reminding the people of their covenant with God, and also consulting kings on military matters and issues of national significance. Peripheral prophets were outsiders who embraced the poor, criticized the monarchy, and opposed war. West ignores these variations, which result in an idealized and deeply flawed portrait of King of peripheral prophets, who is only used when we hug the margin. That Elisha argument is a distorted remnant of King's prophetic profile. As a central prophet, Martin Luther King had been deeply involved with the Johnson ministry effort to pass the right legislation. Beginning already, I'm reading from Leisha. I'm going to go to the board and see whether we got anybody here. Any of you like to make a comment? You can just call 805-727-7013. 805-727-7013. King moved from a central to peripheral prophet in the last 2 years with emphasis on economic justice and anti-war activism. Views he grew in as he wrestled with his conscience, his staff, and the folk to whom he was accountable. But West insists that only peripheral prophets are genuine, and power was undercut by the legislation King helped to pass as a central prophet, the Civil Rights Act, the Voter Rights Act. King was arguably more beneficial to folks he loved when he stayed, when swaying power with his influence and vision.
When West begrudged Sharpton and soldiers, so ignore the fact that King
had similar access. Sharpton and Jackson moved in the opposite of the prophetic direction of King. While King kissed the periphery with courageous vigor, having enjoyed his role as a central prophet, Jackson and especially Sharpton started on the peripheral before coming into our own on the inside. Jackson's transit was smooth by the gulf left by King's assassination. And while forging alliance with outsiders on the black left, he easily adapted the role of the inside outsider who identified with the downcast while making his way to the heart of the Democratic Party. Sharpton, lacking the leeway to drive from Lee's violent death, had instead to kill his persona. The rabble-rousing and inflammatory style of his early days is gone, which remains an elite academic.
and can hardly be said to have even been a true outsider, given his position in the academic elite and his upper reach of the economy. But he hungers to be seen as rebellious. And true West is a school, a commandingly, and a bitter critic who has grown long in the tooth, but short in the tongue when lashing one-time college ally. Leon Richler derides West's work as almost complete worthless in these pages 20 years ago. And although I strongly disagree with Richler's view of West's early work, it would be fitting for West to downsize his ambitions and accept his role as a public intellectual, social gadfly, or merely a paid pest. There's nobility in such roles, and one needs not dress up one's intellectual vocation as a prophetic one. West may draw on prophetic insights. He may look up to prophets on the front line, and he may employ prophetic vocabulary of social dissent. But none of that makes him a prophet. One of West's heroes, Malcolm X, said, just because a cat has a kitten in the oven doesn't make the biscuit. That's what philosophically called a category, philosophy called a category mistake. If West harangues against Obama, not the words of a prophet, then how do we account for his extravagant escoration? That may explain with a bit of a moral psychology West lacks supply to the president. West said in 2011 that my dear brother Barack Obama have a certain fear of free black men. Because as a biracial child growing up in the white world, he always had a fear of being a white man with a black skin. West said when Obama meets an independent black woman, it's frightening. Yet Obama wasn't too frightened to confront West. According to Jonathan Alter's 2013 book, The Centerhold, Obama and his enemies at the 2010 National Urban League Convention, Obama barked at West, I'm not a progressive. What kind of shit is this? Other foul words uttered. West added, Obama cussed me out. A photo of the exchange cut, a photo of the exchange was frozen like a dear brother in the headlight as he smiled and stood speechless. The irony is, as highly charged as his prison has become, West is in some ways not that different from Obama. The president alone wished to be the grand architect of the bipartisanship, to consider either left or right, the bridge between conservative and liberal. West used to fancy him as a similar face, at least he did when he was riding high on bestsellers as a progressive icon. West saw the capital of suffering in black America by steering between the arguments of conservative behaviorists and liberal structuralists. He thought it was important to acknowledge self-inflicted injuries as well as dehumanizing poor. As Steven Steinberg, a sociologist at Queen's College, has argued, West set himself up as a voice of reason and moderation between liberals and conservatives, as the mediator between ideological extremes. Obama has similarly argued that black folks must cultivate more excellence at home and the community, as even as he meant the government to help fight black suffering. West restriction with allies ails black folks in a big part of Obama's plan to involve a personal and behavioral dimension beyond social political change. Let me just say here, Michael Eric Dyson also is an ordained preacher. There are some obligations that comes with that. I'd like to challenge Michael Eric Dyson to come on my show and let's go line by line and let's just see whether or not he meets these standards. For West, there is a politics of conversion, fueled by strong love methods. Nihilism is not overcome by arguments and analysis. It is tamed by love and care, West wrote in Race Matters. And the disease of the soul must be conquered by a turn of one's soul, the transcendental one's own affirmation of one's worth, an affirmation fueled by concerns of others. Obama believes that the blessed should care for the unfortunate, the hallmark of his My Brother's Keeper initiative. West and Obama both advocate intervention for our most vulnerable citizens, but while West focuses on combat market forces that edge at non-market value, love, care, service to others handed down by proceeding. You know, these guys should stop this. West just left Princeton University, a multi-billion dollar institution, went to Union Seminary, bless Union Seminary's heart. What's called is the richest Catholic school in the world, Georgetown University. These Negroes ought to quit. I would say something. Obama's author contends is more practical, offering Pell Grants, stimulus money that saved the job to 100,000 black state and local workers. The Fast Sentencing Act of 2010, which reduces disparate sentences for powder and crack cocaine. The extension of earned income tax credit, which kept millions of working poor from sliding, and the extension of unemployment insurance food stamp, which helped millions of blacks. This is a long article, and I'd like to hear what you say. You can dial it to the phone at 908. We will hear from a brother from, I believe it's our brother in Suwanee, Georgia.
Good afternoon.
You're on the air.
Good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. We can hear you.
Yes, we can hear you. Okay, I've been listening to what you were saying, and I wanted to bring out a couple of points here, and I'm going to use a little bit of history to try to bring it up to 2015, April 2015. There was a term that was used by Imam Muhammad, and that term was used was called spirit. My God, let me see, on the tip of my tongue. Well, I'll go back to Frederick Douglass addressed some of the issues like what we're talking about now. And if we look back in the time of the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, and if you think about it, you look as almost like a time capsule or a pill that a doctor would give you, and the pill would take effect after so many hours in your stomach. It would start doing what it's supposed to do. And Frederick Douglass spoke about it. Other leaders back in the day, if we look back in the 1960s and 70s, we remember those movies that they put out where the African-American, the only thing he could do was be a dope dealer or athlete, and they glorified him with all these fine cars and big clothes and how he did and treated his women. And then the 70s, they had an 80s, they came out with other scenes. Seemed like these things, they come out every 10 years or so, then the 80s and then the 90s. But we've reached a time where intellectuals, it's time that pill seems like it comes to fruition with them. And that there is a spirit, Imam Muhammad said that domineering spirit. That domineering spirit has been around a long time. And I think you mentioned it a few weeks ago when you talked about the Willie Lynch papers. It was even used then. But today it's used more in a scholarly manner. And every so often this comes out, and those people will use even scripture to hide their conversations or in their writings. They'll hide use scripture to hide it in their rhetoric. So I mean, what we're hearing now is a way of attacking a president who is an intellectual, a scholar, and recognized throughout the entire world. But what I'm trying to get at, every so often this thing comes out, especially with African Americans, when we're starting to do some good. And now when you see a program that comes on our television where this domineering spirit that I'm talking about was used quite a bit to attack the African American man through his woman. You look at some of these programs coming on TV. Yes, they're making a lot of money. They're very intellectual. They're good actors. But what is the subliminal or the hidden message in that? Is it one you would want your daughter to hear, or you would want to talk about it in your places of worship in a conversation? But I hear it on the lips of a lot of people about these programs such as Secretary dating the president, African American. Another woman going to prison to protect her husband and all these things. There's a hidden message in that. So I hear another message in this writer that's attacking an intellectual. And I would like for you to comment on this, Brother Imam, my point I'm getting to, if you would. But I see it comes up about every 10 years, it seems like. And every time it comes up, it seems like it's more sophisticated than the past. You follow me? Hello? Hello? I don't know if I'm on the air or not. Hello?
You're on the air. I was just saying you're on mute.
Okay.
Because I didn't want the background noise to be. I heard your question.
I'm making a statement, and the statement is, you know, this comes up every so often, and often the public have forgotten when it happened, when the last time it was used, and then when it comes out again, it seems like it's something fresh and new. But this isn't anything new. This has been used over and over and over again, and sometimes the perpetrator don't realize he or she is being used.
Mm-hmm.
You follow me?
I agree with you.
Yes, because it's a domineering spirit, and there's certain language, certain words one can say in that rhetoric that ignites, forces that domineering spirit to pop its head up. You know, it's like there's an old saying the Native Americans used to use out in the West. The gophers, they'll dig a hole, then they'll pop up their head every so often they pop up their head. So what the people out there did, every time the gopher would get up and go outside of his hole and get something to eat, they put some sand in there, and when he come back, eventually his whole head sticks up. So that's what we're seeing. We're seeing this head come out. And it really has no, the foundation is saying, has nothing that will, if you keep your mind on what they're saying, if they can capture your mind for a period of time, blessings and the potential that Allah has put in us, we get sidetracked. And I think that's what this some of this message is. It's to sidetrack us from our potential and our destiny. Could you comment on that, sir?
Yes, sir, I am, and I just want to say to those who are trying to get in, we're having some technical difficulty with the board. This system, Mr. Alan Levy and company, Blog Talk Radio, put together a real multi-million dollar business, and it just consists of phone lines and actually computers. It's amazing. Enterprise, $12 million plus. I just want to comment on that.
Yeah.
And then I want to take a turn getting to Professor Michael Dyson's critique of Professor West and your comments.
Okay.
It seems to me the most eloquent comments, whether it was James Baldwin ticking down Richard Wright or Skip Gates taking down Du Bois.
Right.
Or Stanley Krauss taking down Albert Burr. We seem to get our pen very well dipped in ink. And all of a sudden, our eloquence come out when we're killing another one.
That's right.
It's
very eloquent.
Mr. Lord Farrakhan became very eloquent when he denounced Malcolm. I'm not saying that I too in the Nation of Islam felt the same way about Malcolm. But I don't relish the destruction, how we just with vitriolic glee and lust to kill each other, cut each other up. I can't help but think of what they used to do to us at Christmas time. They would get us drunk and pay us to gouge each other's eyes out, fight and beat up and engage in debauchery and destruction and an orgy of bloodletting.
This is just what's going on now, only it's doing it on an intellectual level.
Yes,
not so much as to be fair.
West has tried to take others down himself. He's taking the president. So all it is a bloodletting contest.
Right.
Not these men all together would equal the president on a bad day. The president has done more for average African Americans, including me, that gave me 3 to 4 years of unemployment, gave me loan modification, gave millions of people opportunities. But somehow or another,
we can find nothing but blood for our brother.
Let's go back to the day of slavery.
You asked me to comment. I'm making a comment. Go ahead. You can stay on the line because you can help me out. But what I'm saying is, I don't mind criticism. There's the ability to audit the intensity, the love. You know, in Islam, we're told when you're killing an animal, says, Bismillah, Allahu Akbar. Even if you're taking the life of a spider, you shouldn't have a lust for taking the life. So when I'm whooping my child, I shouldn't get in the spirit of whooping my child. I should whoop him with Bismillah, Allahu Akbar. Now, y'all child welfare agency people, I don't want you. I want to be a little long, buddy, ma'am. So give me a few minutes to really elaborate. I'm glad you're here because you're helping me. I wasn't prepared to do this show today. Somebody else was supposed to be the guest. They didn't show up. This is what people don't understand about working. You're out here by yourself. Everybody can do, get on the internet, and all they can do is spend that time criticizing somebody, tearing somebody down. Then there are people who are not information freaks. They'll get all the information in the world. They go from one talk show to the other. They go from one program to the other. All they do is spending time critiquing, but they're not doing anything to change the ugly circumstances of our people's lives. I'm not with those people either. A blood fest, a learning fest. I want knowledge to change and make the world better first for myself. When I say myself, I'm talking my own people, not my individual self. I long forgotten myself. If I did, I'd be somewhere chilling. But at my age, I can't chill. I'm too burdened. I would love to bring Michael Eric Dyson, Reverend Michael Eric Dyson, a pastor. I do agree with him that Professor West, by not being an ordained preacher, puts himself in a situation where he is not accountable. He operates as a preacher, but he doesn't have the credentials or the strictures of a preacher. You know, he's not at the risk of being defrocked. Well, somebody would ask the question, maybe Reverend Dyson should be defrocked. But it hasn't happened. I think a lot of things these men spout are questionable as religious men. And I have an open challenge to both of them, including Professor West. I was with Professor West last week at the Bethany Church. Here's the problem that I have with the Muslims in this community. We sit back and let people just act, and we don't challenge them. We'd rather get on the internet and argue with each other. Unlike myself, we would go out and meet them and debate and discussion. So let us be more honest and forthright. And let's not challenge these men in the spirit of destroying them. Let's challenge them in the spirit of making a better community for our people. I'll shut up and listen to your comments and any of your interlocutories.
Brother Imam, are you still there?
I'm still here.
Oh, okay. I didn't know if I was still on here. Yes, I think the way to approach it. Hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. The best way to approach that is, you just said it in a nutshell. What can I do to help you? What can I do to tear you down? I mean, we have our differences. That is expected. But it seems like it comes up in a timely manner, usually around election days. Election time, around certain holidays or some particular political upheaval is going on in some part of the world. That's when these individuals seem to come to the forefront or brought to the forefront for whatever reason it may be. But I think you're right. We need to challenge each other on an intellectual way and in a debate that doesn't have a deceptive to deceive the public.
Right. That's what I want. I want to see this program turn into that kind of thing. I want this to be some religious program where we're just talking to each other in a congratulatory type manner, where we are just really masturbating in real sense That's what each other, and that's what a lot of us really want to do. We're afraid to go out and meet. Or even when we do meet with people, it's like some, they got to insult outsiders. I know brothers who come on the program and they got to insult somebody because they're not Muslim, because they feel envious and jealous. And I know brothers who come on the program because someone is educated, put them down, put somebody down because they speak Arabic. Stop that kind of stuff. That's disruptive. You're feeding into the Willie Lynch syndrome. You're just
right.
Shown naked clothes that you don't have any clothes on, that you're nothing but a first-rate slave. That's all you're exhibiting, cutting off people, whooping people. All that is nothing but psychological destruction. What the Ahmadinejad Muhammad did was tell you,
well, history is best qualified to reward all research.
No, I wasn't going to say that. That wasn't what I was going to say. Ahmadinejad Muhammad said, tell you, he took that anger of ours and turned that anger into work. Pick up some papers. Contribute. See, in other words, we are angry. We are justifiably angry. A lot of harm has been done to us. But it's okay to be angry. Don't turn the anger against yourself and against others. Take it and work. Help build a store. Help build a school. Help pull some young person up. Help motivate somebody. Take that anger and construct a better person out of yourself, a better family, a better neighborhood, a better nation, a better race, a better economy. Take that energy and anger and go and read a book and then explain it to somebody. Take that anger and use it to explain and read to somebody who may stand on the corner and read them one of Imam Muhammad's lectures. Tell them that Brother God has a message for you. That's what we need to do. We need to go out here. Don't sit back and criticize, backbite, and destroy people. That's some of us. All we do is relish in bloodletting and destroying people. And even though this is probably one of the most eloquent pieces by Michael Eric Dyson, and Reverend Dyson, I don't want to call him. We should stop this.
Dr. Dyson.
Well, I'd rather call him Reverend Dyson, the ordained preacher. As a title,
okay.
even though he is Dr. Dyson, he earned it. But he is also a pastor, and as a result of him being a pastor, he has obligations. There are certain obligations that he took when he was ordained. There are certain questions that you are asked when you're ordained. Do you uphold the gospel of Jesus Christ? Do you believe it? Do you believe that you should take care of the poor? They ask such questions as this. The Spirit, have you been moved by the Spirit? Yes, I've been moved by the Spirit. Do you believe that the Spirit of the Lord is upon you? Have you been anointed to preach good news to the poor, to give liberty to the captive, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord? Those are obligations that one has to answer. And then once has agreed to that, then they've been dedicated to the gospel ministry. So I know that because I was a part of that. And I must tell you, those obligations go with, even though I no longer accept to be a Baptist preacher, I still accept the obligation that I took when they asked me in the temple. How many of you believe that this message is good, that's right and good for the black man? I raised my hand. And that we should still accept that. That we should be, I hope, my African-American Christian preachers who have taken on that obligation will stand in awe of Jesus, stand in awe of David Walker, stand in the awe of the great African-American preachers and say that I got an obligation. So I'm going to shut up, Brother Samuel, Brother Imam Samuel, and you can ask me any questions or comments. Or if you don't, if you can't reach us, I'm told that people can't get into the queue for some reasons. They can't press one on the phone. Brother Imam Samuel got through. I don't know how others are not getting through. But if you'd like to text me, you can text me, Imam Alfred, 908-463-4843, and text your question. And I will read your questions on the air or your comments. So, Brother Imam, continue with any questions or comments you wish today.
Yes, I think that What you're saying is so true. There is an obligation and a responsibility when you take an oath. There's an obligation and a responsibility when you have a position, whether it's, and especially in the community. And that obligation and responsibility is something that one shouldn't take lightly and try to use words to get around the reality of what's going on in America and not let politics play a part in your decision or how you pursue your responsibility. And having said that, I see the same old identity coming up again, and that identity is, it seems like the house Negro and the field Negro are at each other's throat. That's what it would lead one to believe, you know?
That's exactly right.
And those of us that, especially young people, be younger than 45 years old, many of them don't want to look back and see the history that our families went through, our people went through, because it's so demonic and so devastating that they don't want to see it because they get mad. But that is the same principle that was applied then is applying now, only they're not doing it from a physical standpoint, they're doing it from a psychological and a immoral standpoint.
Right.
So I see these traits coming up over and over again. Every 10 years, and I've been noticing this for about 60 years now, every 10 years something like this comes up. And now we have more of our people, and I'm talking about people who are right-minded, thinking the same way, reach the level in America, all across America, on different systems of knowledge are very well, not only well educated, but are thinkers. And when I hear something like this, it seems like it's to throw mud on the attempts of some of these people. And some of us, I won't go into nationalism, but because that was part of our history too. But I mean,
nothing wrong with a healthy nationalism, in my opinion. It's good.
Say what?
America is a beautiful land. What makes America such a great land?
That's right.
Despite all our pain, is America can accommodate my nationalism.
Yes.
I can be an Amish nationalist. I can be a German nationalist. I can be a Russian nationalist, still fit into the USA. And I can be an African American nationalist, which I am.
I'm
African American Muslim nationalist, and I can live my life. I don't have to sit down. Nobody gonna force me to have to marry a white woman. Nobody can force me to move into that neighborhood. I can make heaven on earth right in my neighborhood. That's the only man in the world that we can do that. Now, those of us who are into a beggar-thon, want to try to make white folks love us, but this is not a land for you. I don't object to you having an objection to that. But as far as I'm concerned, Princeton and Harvard and Yale, they could go to hell as far as I'm concerned. I mean, they don't impress me. That's me. I want to see us have our own institutions. I want to see us compete with them. I don't want to join them. Yes, I'm a racial essentialist. Yes, I'm an ethnic essentialist. But I'm also a live and let live. I don't mind the WASPs having their Harvard. I don't mind the WASPs having their institute. I don't mind the Jews having Brandeis. I don't mind the Mormons having Brigham Young. I don't mind the Catholics having Georgetown. I'm not going to say it's mine. It's theirs. If they choose to let me come into that institute, thank God. Now, as far as City Hall, I feel I'm on City Hall as much as they do. But America should have a right. I should have a right to private institutions. I should have a right to compete. I want African Americans to build their own institutions, build their own neighborhoods, build their own schools, and compete with everybody like we compete on the basketball court, like we compete on the football field, like we compete in the boxing ring, and win. I mean, ma'am, you're getting me excited.
Well, you know, as a youngster,
10,000 people.
You know, as a youngster, I remember very well. I had to go to a hospital once, in late 1940s, and I was in North Carolina, and the hospital was in Henderson, North Carolina. And I remember looking out the window, and I could see down the street from the hospital, there was the schools that were all African-American because it was segregated at that time. The drug stores were owned by African-Americans. We used to call them filling stations, were owned by African-Americans, hardware stores, and grocery stores and so on. We saw all that. And I remember going to, and it was all black doctors. And they were very, very competent in the business and in the medical community. But we misunderstood when it came to integration. We misunderstood, I mean, we, the African-American, misunderstood. We had to give up something to join something else. And that's when we gave up, we lost our economic, we lost our political strength, and we lost a great deal of our unity because we gave up something. So, many young folks today may be listening. They may not have experienced that, but I've heard people make statements that we've come a long ways. I don't share that thought. I share the thought that how far we would have been going if we never had a heel on a boot
That's right.
on our neck. I mean, you had to have a boot on my neck. I would have been much farther. I mean, my potential, our potential that's put in us from the time when we was a liquid to the time, you know, we grew up to be adults was put in us by Almighty God Allah. And when people use methods to suppress that, that's one of the greatest sins that a person can commit, a people can commit against another people, not just killing them, but to suppress them or keep them from reaching their full potential. And some of the information I heard you read today, I didn't hear it all. I came in a little late. But some of the information I heard you read today, I'm listening to that deceiving spirit that will cast doubt in the back of a person's mind, or subliminally cast doubt that what an individual can achieve, or individual groups can achieve. Maybe you want to elaborate more on that. I'm not trying to take over your show, don't get me wrong.
No, brother, it's fine. You're helping me out. I mean, I don't know even how Allah blessed me to do this show today. I didn't intend that we had a young lady who was supposed to be on the show, Latino Muslim. I wanted her views. She didn't show. Came in, we had technical problems. I'm told that people have been trying to get on the show, can't get on. And, like I say, Blog Talk has gone through a lot of changes. The company. I also want people to know this show is not free. We don't pay. So we need you to send your donation. Imam Alfred Muhammad, 817 Jackson Avenue, Linden, New Jersey, 07036. We desperately need your donation. In order for us to expand this show and advertise, we need money. But these people require every month a payment from us. So those of you who sit back and listen to land and you enjoying the program, send us $10. It's just the people that listen to this show sent us $10. But we have a real, every time somebody asks us for money now, we think that they're a crook. We got to learn to trust somebody. Now, if you don't trust me, find somebody you trust. If you can't lead, follow. If you can't follow, lead. You'll find nobody. You should look at yourself. You can't find nobody you can trust. You should have some place that you're paying charity to, some leader that you're loyal to. That's the only way we're going to grow. I'm going to shut up, buddy, ma'am. We got about 10
no,
minutes.
No. You keep talking. I like to hear more. I like to hear more about that letter, and perhaps in pieces, a paragraph of it. And I think we can take it from in that direction.
All right, let me go back to reading it.
Okay, and let's take a paragraph at a time. Go ahead, please.
All right, just a minute. I had it. It's on my phone, right? I'm reading it, and I've taken my glasses off to read it, and it's. I tell you, I'm amazed I can read that long. But y'all just bear with me. Make some comments while I look. Comment until I find it. I'll tell you when I'm ready.
Continue, brother, man.
Well, as a people who maybe new in politics to some degree, I'm talking about large numbers, new in politics. I think listen to what's being said, because a lot of it is nothing more than rhetoric. There's no logic in it. Listening to some of the negative things that were said about the Democratic person that's running for president, and I hear all it, but there's no logic in it. And it's the same thing with what some of this letter is. Some of it has logic in it, and some of it doesn't. So I think it's a good to sit down and listen to it, and even if you have to reread it again and again, to get the message of the problem face out of it, and so you can discuss it or debate it. Now, I'm hoping that we'll get some calls in, because I'd like to hear what people are thinking.
I think there's something a little wrong with the whole system now. People are listening, but they can't get in.
I tried to punch out, and I couldn't do it. After I punched in, I couldn't punch out. So it must be
all
something
right,
wrong with it.
Let me continue to read.
All right.
Okay. I'm going to read a... The odd thing is that Obama talks right, chiding personally irresponsibility the way they presume the pathology of many black neighbors and family that veers left in his public policy. Bush, on the other hand, talks left and thinks right in his notion of nihilism and the fact that might reduce his peril. In race matters, West argues that the spiritual malady of nihilism is the greatest threat to black America, not racism, not class inequality, not material hardship or poverty or hyper-incarceration. Steinberg rightly argues that it takes half-splitting distinctions that do not bear scrutiny to maintain the Westview of nihilism is different from the conservative view of ghetto culture as deeply pathological. And let me just stop here and say, this is no more than what E. Franklin Frazier and other social scientists know. Kenneth Clark and others have argued, slavery made pathology. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad's project. Now, I know some of you who say, well, this ain't me. Well, you're the exception. Your family may not have been pathological. You may not be from this. But the vast majority of us are from pathology. That's a fact. I'm prepared to argue with any social scientist on that, period. And I don't claim to be a social scientist. I claim to be no more, no less than a preacher. But I claim to be versed in social science. I claim to be versed in social policy. I claim to be versed in social transformation. Because after all, I've been in a movement that has transformed millions of people's lives. I told a young man today, he sounded very hopeless. I said, young man, I won't name him because he probably listened to the show. I said, we took Malcolm X, who was a bigger criminal than you, and sent him to Oxford, and he beat everybody at the Oxford debate. Think of what we can do with you. If we put you in our cannons and gave you the 105, 150, 300 books that we had to read as part of the Nation of Islam canon. This is the early nation before it was taken over by the commercial materialists and the criminals. The Rise of the West, Willie and Harold Durant, Gibbons, The Rise and the Fall of the Roman Empire. All these kinds of books were read by the members of the Nation of Islam. Some people didn't even have a high school diploma. Some was barely literate. I know a man that you see him on talk shows now. Certainly he's with Minister Farrakhan. I won't name him. I want to call him out. He came into the temple. He was illiterate. And a brother taught him how to read and write. And
well,
now
see,
this
brother,
man
brother,
is up and down the world. So let me continue.
Brother Imam, that was the point that
I want to put into this article, and then I want you to comment.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
And Ray Sanders was argued that the spiritual malady of nihilism
is the greatest threat to black America. Not racism. This is West, not me. Not class inequality, not material hardship or poverty, hyper incarceration. Steinberg rightly argued that it takes has-been distinctions that do not bear close scrutiny to maintain the West view of nihilism is different from the conservative view of ghetto culture is deeply pathological, and that the chief source of the problem that beset African Americans. Steinberg says that despite frequent caveats, West has succeeded in shifting the focus of blame onto the black community. The affliction is there, something we call nihilism. West did as much to slam the poor with his stylish postmodern update of ghetto pathology and blame the victim reason as any conservative thinker. He gave the notion ideological cover. Well, I want to ask Reverend Dr. Dyson from Tabernacle Baptist Church in Detroit, Michigan, where one of the most eloquent pastors who's not going on to his death reward used to pastor. How does he equate scripture which says, be ye not conformed to the world, but be ye transformed by the word of God? How do you deal with that, Reverend Dyson? How do you say to people that in spite of poverty, in spite of the threat of physical annihilation, you yet keep on with the spirit? How is it that people were surrounded by all kinds of vices, but they refused to give over to crime? They refused to give over to vandalism. They refused to be marauders. They held to what they believed in, the old rugged cross. And I'm not talking about the rugged cross, as you know it in Christianity, the cross in its original sense, which meant that I mastered myself. I moved to control my heart, and I stretched out my hands and legs. That's the cross that we're talking about. That's the universal cross, not the cross of imminent suffering and death. That's what that meant. And how people believe that.
You're talking about Christ consciousness.
Yeah, that's right. That's what I'm talking about. Absolutely.
Yeah, you're talking about.
I
think that has to be that should be separated. The physical versus Christ conscience. They have to understand the difference.
That's what I'm explaining. I'm explaining to that. I'm sure Reverend Dyson, I'm speaking to him and his crowd. They understand what I'm talking about. Reverend Dyson attended Princeton Theological Seminary and Princeton University. So he understands metaphysics. He knows it's not talking about the literal cross. I was with a preacher recently, and he prayed in the name of the Almighty God. How Christian preachers, I'm not talking about Reverend Hoop and Holland, but they also read the Bible just like I read the Bible. Someone asked me, he said, do you believe that so-and-so believe in the resurrection? I said, yes, I certainly believe. This is a very prominent preacher in New York City. One of his members asked him, did he believe in the resurrection? So I'm certain he believed in the resurrection. And he looked at me as though he questioned it. I said, but the resurrection that I believe in, and that is that human life comes here with life, it is buried under the culture, and by God's grace, it is resurrected. So I believe in the resurrection every day, but not the resurrection of the physical dead, but the resurrection of the mentally dead. Yes, sir, my brother. I'm sorry to the audience who's trying to call in that you can't reach us. I don't know what happened. I will bring the tickets up with Blog Talk Radio. Thank you. Go ahead, brother, my dear brother.
No, I was, please excuse me. I was drinking some water. I was listening to what you were saying, and the emotional way the reaching people just through their emotions, it will never change any conditions in themselves or our people. We have to reach them from intellectual, a moral, and a spiritual. All that has to be balanced. And I'm not hearing that in that letter that you were reading. I'm not hearing an answer to what should be done. I'm hearing the only thing I'm hearing about, hearing from that is it's a you know, condemnation or what's wrong with him. Well, where's the alternative in that letter? Or maybe you haven't read it yet. Or you haven't got to it.
This is a not a letter. It is an article in the New Republic, but it is not. I don't think he's proposing any solutions. He's given an analysis, which I must tell you is a very eloquent analysis. One of the best works of my Reverend Dyson that I've read. I read Reverend, tried to read Reverend Dyson's works. And I must tell you, it has been lacking. He hasn't had much of a scholarship himself. I do know this about Professor West. Professor West is an accessible person. He talks to anybody on the street. He treats all people nice. He's one of the nicest human beings on earth. I do know that he's pained, I'm sure. He has to play a left wing. He figures he has to be a left-wing icon. I don't know what he really believes, but I know one thing. It's a shame that the condition of our people. I think the Reverend Dyson and our dear brother, Professor West, would be wise if they were to go into these neighborhoods and call Ray Ray and Keisha to their better self. I think they should take their celebrity status and do what the brothers in the Lost Foundation of Islam and Minister Farrakhan's Nation of Islam are trying to do. I don't condone anything that Brother Minister Farrakhan says other than the good he says. But I do know that our brother, Minister Farrakhan, every Wednesday, every Friday, every Sunday, will transform for people's lives. I can't deny that. I cannot deny the fact that Professor West is accessible and has helped people. I don't know about Reverend Dyson doing anything. I've never had any success reaching Reverend Dyson. Reverend Dyson reminds me a lot of Prophet Jones, reminds me a lot of the hustling preachers that have come out of Detroit, Michigan. And in many cases, even though he's a learned man, he represents the worst or the best or the worst in black thuggery. I just don't like that. I do know West is a much nicer person. And I do think part of our job that God has raised us up, particularly if we say we're men of religion, we're elevated to be the light into a darkened world. Now, you Muslim brothers, I'm not letting you off the hook. You have to be a light in a dark world. I don't come out of my house or meet the public, even to take my garbage out, unless I'm thinking about turning my light on to be the light, to try to say something to somebody, to pick them up, to make them feel better. And I think we should do the same. Brother Imam, you have any close thoughts?
Well, I think one of the greatest compliments that I received was about 10 years ago, one of the greatest compliments. And that's not the only time it happened, but it happened in a group of people that I was just moved to a new, moved to the area that I live in, and I was socialized with people, my peers, my age, and one of the things that that the young lady said, a woman said to me, she says, "I want to ask you a question," and I said, "Certainly, you go ahead." She said, "I want to ask, are you a Muslim?" I said, "Yes, ma'am, I am." I said, "Well, why did you ask?" She said, "I knew it was something different about you." She said, "The way you conduct yourself, and the way you carry yourself, and the way you treat women," she said, "I thought you was a Muslim." Now, I'm not looking for any pats on the back or anything like that. Only Allah can reward me. But that attitude or that posture that I had, I hope I still have it, when people can look at you and distinguish you from somebody else because of your, the way your conduct, carry yourself and your conduct, then that's what we should. That's, I think that's something we need to work with.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on that?
I agree. I think that we should be a witness. One of the things that we are told as Muslims is the I bear witness. I bear just like you would bear arms.
Mm-hmm.
That there is no God but God. So people should see in your life that there's no authority in your life but God. And that you should carry the message of Muhammad. You shouldn't see Muhammad as God. You shouldn't operate as God. You are under the authority of the one that created the sun, the moon, and the stars, and everything that you can see and can't see.
Yeah,
you should
yeah.
feel that. There should be a bit of humility in you.
Mm-hmm.
And you should see a young man walking down the street, and he's getting good grades, and you should say congratulations to him. He should feel that you're praising him for his good, that you're acknowledging, as the Hindus say, namaskar, the God for the divine spirit in you, greet the divine spirit in me. That's how we should see people. And especially...
May I also add to that, appearance means a lot. How do we dress? Years ago, we wore suits and ties. I'm not suggesting that everyone should wear a suit and tie, but I think we should... I'm going to adorn ourselves the best that we can, because we are when one carries himself like that, he's representing God's will and God's word. And
I believe in that. I don't rarely accept in my neighborhood. I'm always in my uniform.
Yes.
Because
you brought up something a moment
uniform,
ago.
I'm generally wearing a white shirt,
mm-hmm.
a shine pair of shoes.
That's right.
And a doing that. I represent that so I can be a light and I can be distinguished. My courage, I don't walk like I'm a so-called American Negro. I don't walk and act. I don't gesture like that. I'm not trying to be a hip-hop guy. I'm not
mm-hmm.
trying to be relevant. I'm trying to be what I am, a reflection of the Word of God, loving humanity. In myself first, I mean in my own people. You know, I heard people talk, I'm worried about the Palestinians. Good for you. I'm worried about the African American first.
Well,
I
got them on my back burner. Well, you know, you said something about Malcolm earlier. We sent Malcolm all the way to Oxford, Yale, and Harvard, and many other institutions, spoke with kings and queens and prime ministers of countries. But that potential, he was able to bring out that God, Almighty Allah put in him. God put that in him, and he was able to bring it out in our community. And that's what a lot of us need to understand. That same potential, whatever our potential is in us, can be brought out if we conduct and carry ourselves in a manner.
Right. But the reason I make this clear.
But that, yeah.
Malcolm had the potential, and a lot of young people had the potential. But that potential would have never been actualized.
That's right. That's my point.
Not in an environment of
mm-hmm.
serious men with a great call to him. You know, a lot of people, they want to deny the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. See, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad himself is a study in human potential. But it was somebody who turned him on to his human potential.
That's right.
And he was excited by his human potential, that he was able to turn on millions, including myself, including you and others. So, yes, Malcolm had a great potential, but there's millions of young men right in the penitentiary got potential.
That's right.
Who died today with potential, but he hasn't been put in an environment that will awaken that potential and bring it out. He hadn't been put in an environment with other people who affirm his potential, who glorify his potential and lift him up, cause him to be an atom smasher, to read and to study. That hasn't happened. And we got to have that environment today. We got to have an
yes.
environment where learning is pushed, where earning a lawful living is pushed, where refinement and good, nice, melodious music is pushed, where art is pushed,
together, choose a leader. Stop being anarchistical. Stop being anti-organizational. You know how to watch windows, get together and put up a watch, window watching company. Teach another brother to be sincere how to watch windows. There's millions of dollars in there. Teach somebody how to put some floors down. These are things we can do. We got to do these things on our level, and that's what Religion Means Alive is about. It's not talking religious rhetoric. It is to develop the community. Brother Imam, I'm going to close out. I thank you. You have helped me tremendously, and I thank Allah because when I came to do this show today, the board was messed up. Computer was messed up. I couldn't get into the board. See, this show looks easy, but it's not. You know it. You're a broadcaster.
Yeah.
So we had somebody show up. I intended to play a tape.
Let me say this before you go. A
person
who is employed, a self-employed window washer, is better than a CEO that's out of work.
That's right.
He's got more dignity. So you can be a CEO of yourself at window washing company, but that CEO that's unemployed, what's he going to do? Thank you, brother.
That's right. Thank you all. My listening audience, for listening, I apologize to you who could not get on the show. May the creed of the heavens and earth bless each and every one of you. We'll see you tomorrow on Religion Means Alive, where our guest will be Murad Muhammad. Thank you.